Getting the latest episode of Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bowman Show. Here it is from TuneIn.
Hello?
Podcast of verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Hello, can I talk to Mr. David? Dave Bowman?
Approach and identify.
Hello?
A large black coffee.
A what?
Large black coffee.
Do you mean a venti?
No, I mean a large.
He means a venti. Yeah, the biggest one you got. Venti is large.
No, venti is 20.
Danny.
Yeah, large is large. In fact, tall is large, and grande is Spanish for large. Venti's the only one that doesn't mean large. It's also the only one that's Italian. Congratulations, you're stupid in three languages.
From the packed Northwest studio of the Podcast 99 Network, located in beautiful downtown Silverdale, Washington, this is Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show podcast. Now, here's your host, the submarine-qualified, well-coffeed, rules-driven, elitist history buff, Dave Bowman.
Weapons calling, you have permission to fire.
Have permission to fire, con weapons eye.
Well, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today. Most of them are far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity, debates, discussion, biases, the Supreme Court, history, and humanity. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a while. Well, let the blood sports begin. 104 years ago, different people looked at the same event and came to radically different conclusions. What was the result? Millions of people would die. Now we have arguments over things people see differently every day. Ultimately, what is the cost? Here's how you get a hold of me. 565-DAVE, 209-565-3283 is the text machine and the voicemail machine. The email is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show. Just about anywhere on Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes. Eloqui cognitio, the greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance. It is the appearance of knowledge. Jean-Jacques Rousseau was one of the great philosophers of the Enlightenment. Certainly someone who the framers knew very, very well. Once said, "Hatred, as well as love, renders its votaries credulous." Now in your head, you're going, "Oh, that makes sense." But did you really think about what it means? And did you keep in mind that he was writing that in the 1700s, the early 1700s, when words had different meanings than they have now? It's kind of the underlying theme of the program today, is this hatred as well as love renders its votaries credulous. And we look at the philosophy, I guess, of what's going on in the world right now. We are watching, I don't even know how to describe it. Justice Kennedy was appointed by Ronald Reagan, the conservative of conservative presidents, and is beloved, or at least today is being praised by the far left, because now that he's going away, oh my God, this voice of reason that was appointed by the person we hate more than anybody is going away, and that means that somebody worse is going to come in, or better is going to come in, or whatever. Meanwhile, Justice Roberts, who was appointed by George W. Bush, and then immediately named as the Chief Justice by George W. Bush, is the guy that's solely responsible for saving the signature piece of legislation of the Obama legacy. It was John Roberts who decided that a fine is a tax, and therefore, even though you say it's not a tax, it is a tax. So, yes, Obamacare is legal. So a conservative justice appointed by a Republican president saves Obamacare. Kennedy, who is, in my view, pretty libertarian, a swing vote, as it were, a moderate, as it were, appointed by the most conservative judge in the world, is retiring, and people are losing their minds. it would be humorous if it wasn't so important. The degree to which people are falling apart over this, the unabashed anger over this. Oh, this guy's resigned. This is why Trump shouldn't have been elected. Now the court is going to be this, that, and the other. Everybody's saying, well, now the decisions will be 6-4. No, they won't. They can't be 6-4. I actually saw a guy post that. Oh, great. I foresee a bunch of 6-4 decisions in the future. No, you don't. Not unless you're doing math in a way that I don't understand, like base 9 or something. Still going to be 5-4, no matter how you slice it. Even if the president appoints the most originalist conservative, even if he raises Antonin Scalia from the dead and appoints him to the court, still going to be 5-4. It's not, it's 6-4. It's like, are you kidding me? How do you get a 6-4 decision on a 9-person court? Oh, I didn't think about that. Yeah, I know. That's the problem, is nobody's thinking. Everybody's reacting. Oh my God. This is horrifying. This is the apocalypse versus, yeah, we're going to stick it to them now. Boy, we're going to overturn everything. The truth is so far from either perspective. It's not even funny. But when you think about it in the broader scheme of things, what we're about to watch happen over the next few weeks, next few months, is it's going to be embarrassing. I mean, there's no two ways about that. You're going to watch a bunch of people who are allegedly intelligent, allegedly smart, allegedly the best and the brightest of this country do absolutely stupid, inane, and ridiculous things. There won't be as much a discussion as there will be a zinger fight. And at the end of the day, we don't really care who the nominee is. Nobody really cares. Nobody really cares what the nominee thinks, says, or does, except for one thing. And by God, that thing is the litmus test. And if we don't pass the litmus test, then one side is going to condemn him no matter who or what he is. Even if it's John Roberts and he doesn't pass their test, but he saves their signature piece of legislation, they still hate him. And even though this guy who does pass their litmus test and is appointed by a conservative president, the other side's going to hate him. And at the end of the day, we still won't know anything. I find it fascinating that you can take two people and you can show them the exact same thing. Oh, here's a cup. I'm holding it up if you're watching on the video. And those two people can look at that cup and come to two radically opposed, diametrically opposed conclusions about that cup. You can have an argument about this cup. Oh, it's full of a delicious dark liquid. Oh, that stuff's horrifying. That stuff's bad. No, that stuff's great. No, that stuff causes cancer. There's no scientific evidence that it causes cancer. That stuff's disgusting. Put sugar in it. It's bad for you. Well, I don't put sugar in it, so what do you care? Isn't it my right to drink what I want to drink? No, it should be registered. Two people can have an argument over a cup. And in that argument, no one will ever ask the question, why do you think that? No one will ever take the time to say, let me tell you why I think this way. No one will ever take the time to discuss the background of, Dave, why do you like coffee so much? Ben actually asked me that the other day. Why do you like coffee so much? Well, because it lifts you up, it picks you up, it makes you strong. It's the drink that drives the dreams of champions, was my response. But I think there's actually a bit more to it than that. I was just trying to be funny with him, and he didn't get the joke. Mainly because he's never seen that movie. You can pick any topic you want. I don't really care what it is. Religion, that's mostly where I've seen this effect happen, is religion. Okay, here's some words on a page. Pick a page, it doesn't matter. Here are some words on a page that say X. And two people can look at those same words and come to completely different positions on what it means. God said, let there be light. Well, what does that mean? And depending on who you have in the room, you could have not just two opinions, you could have 20 opinions as to what that means. Does it mean that God actually created light? Does it mean that God caused light to be created? Does it mean that, is it an allegory that means that, you know, early man was trying to explain how light was created, much as the Greeks tried to explain how the world was created, you know, by regurgitating rocks or something like that. And the Native Americans have their myths of, you know, the blood ball being kicked or the Kachkavoryans. I butchered that name, you know, believe that existence was sneezed into existence. So who knows what it actually means? And you could have the more differing opinions you have there, the more intense the debate will become. And no one will ever stop to say, why do you think that way? What causes you? What's the process by which you develop this belief that you have about those words? And you better hope it's not words that start with, and the Lord saith unto them. Because once you get into that, then you really get into arguments and debates. Well, what does that mean? The Lord said, thou shalt not. The Lord said, thou shalt not do this thing. Well, but that was written for people a long time ago. No, it still applies today. Because, you know, it has to. Oh, my God. You will spend way too much of your life being dragged into that argument than you want to. And the unfortunate thing of this is that, again, no one spends the time to discuss why you think that way. What are your experiences? What are your biases that cause you to conclude things are a certain way, regardless of any outside or external effects on this? People don't like to change their minds about things. People like to make up their minds instantaneously, and they're set. God forbid they should actually have to think about something. God forbid they should actually, I don't know, consider things. Because once you start considering things, once you start thinking about things, once you start asking yourself questions about things, or God forbid somebody else starts asking you probing questions about things, then we either clam up and become very defensive. Let's play the zinger game. Let's play the insult game. Or we find ourselves being introspective in a way that's uncomfortable. A long time ago, I was a junior in high school, and I loved chess. I still like chess. It's still one of my favorite games to play. I don't play it very often because, frankly, you know, it's kind of a, I don't know why I don't play much anymore. I just don't. My wife doesn't play. My son hasn't learned the game yet. So it's just not something that I do a lot of. But when I was in high school, I loved playing chess. In fact, if you'll permit me a moment of unbridled bragging, at one point I was ranked fourth in the school. We had 320 people in school, but not everybody played chess. But in our chess club, I was ranked fourth for about a day. Hooray me. and then it took a tumble from there. So, but I felt like that was a major accomplishment. My mother knew that I liked chess. And one day she was walking through a thrift store and she found a game on the shelf there. It was a game and it said, a military chess game. A game of military chess. Something to that effect. And she bought it. The name of the game was Tactics 2. It was put out by a company that was famous for putting out board games and war games called Avalon Hill. And she brought it home to me and she said, I thought you might like this. And she was wrong. I did not like it. I loved it. I played this game months, solitaire against myself, read the rule book and played this game and just had a ball doing it. And then finally one day I met somebody at school who also played Avalon Hill games. And I said, well, maybe we should get together and play. And we did. And he proceeded to absolutely, oh, I guess the term John Madden would use, he slobber knocked me. And every time he would do something that I thought, that's not right, he would show me the rules. He'd say, well, look, it's right here. And I would read it. I would say, well, that's not what that means. That means this. And he would show me on the board. No, because if you do this, 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 and this, see how that works? And the light bulb would go on, and I'd go, oh. And then I'd get my butt kicked some more. And on we would go. And eventually, my friend Lee and I, we became basically a game club where we played these board games. And really, there's a one of those memes out there about war gamers, you know, what we really do, what our friends think we do, what we think we do, what my mom thinks we do. And then the last phrase, what we really do, which is faces buried in rule books, because these rule books would be 60, 70, 80 pages long. And you would have to know these rules intimately. And even then, there was disagreement about what the rules meant, about how you interpreted them. And even today, I run into people that I know are interpreting some of these rules incorrectly. And I think to myself, I should fix that. And then I think, why bother? Not getting involved with that argument. But the difference, what I learned in that experience was that if we took the time to actually dissect it, if we took the time to say, okay, why do you think it's that way? Why do you think it's this way? And what really, and we put them both on the paper on the table, and we talked through it until it made sense to everybody, or we could agree on what it meant, rather than just simply saying, well, for me, it's this, and for you, it's that. You can't play a game where I think the rules are one thing and you think the rules are another. When I'm up, we play by my rules. When you're up, you play by your rules. That's kind of what my son does sometimes with his game. So I'm changing the rules because you're winning. You can't function that way. It makes it very difficult to have a society, to have a community, to have any kind of relationship with people when everything is my way or the highway, or your way in the high or the highway. And nobody understands why the other person thinks the way they do. I mean, take it back to religion for just a moment or two. You get this split. I don't even want to talk about the Roman Catholic Protestant split because that has deeper. But even within the Protestant community, how many denominations of Protestantism are there? And what are the things that divide them? Sometimes angrily between those particular denominations. Now, look, I'm a person who believes that denominationalism is not a bad thing. I believe that denominationalism is mission driven. In other words, not everybody is tasked by God to do a specific thing. Some people are tasked to do another thing. And so you tend to clump together with people who share your vision and your ideas and your direction and your sense of mission. And that's how you develop denominationalism. But then they divide it even further by going, well, you have to be fully baptized. All right, what does that mean? Well, for some people, it means you got to have a little water sprinkled on you. And for other people, it means you got to be completely dunked in the River Jordan. And for other people, it means you have to speak in tongues. And if you don't speak in tongues, you're not saved. And for other people, it's you can't partake of this, or you can't drink that, or you can't eat this, or you can't go there, or you can't say those words, or you can't. And yet they all say, because I'm not one of them anymore, they all say we believe the same thing. Well, then what are you arguing about? And why do you have these different divisions and these different ideologies? Charum says, I still don't know what Methodism is. I know. But have you ever sat down with a Methodist and said, okay, why do you believe this way? What is it that makes Methodism? What is it that makes Baptistism? What is it that makes Lutheranism? What is it that your thought processes have taken you in this direction, that this is what's best for you? I talk about my own faith all the time. I don't expect anybody else to follow my footsteps. I really don't. I have no idea why God decided that I was going to be a certain way and a certain thing. And I, to this day, I don't know why he decided that. I do know that the rabbis teach that if you're still alive, whatever it is you're supposed to be doing isn't done yet. So I assume that there's still something for me to do. But I don't know what it is. I'm 54, almost 55 years old, and I ain't figured it out yet. So I'm pretty sure other people haven't either. We never take the time then to sit down and discuss what it is that we're thinking. Why are we thinking this way? Not with a critical eye, not with a, oh, you're wrong mentality, because how do you know if they're wrong if you don't know what they're thinking? How do you know somebody else is wrong if you don't know why they're thinking that way or doing that thing or saying those words or drinking that drink or whatever you want to talk about? It was 104 years ago today that a group of, I don't know, some have called them anarchists, others have called them terrorists, some have called them freedom fighters, some have called them nationalists, some have called them assassins, shot the Archduke Ferdinand and his wife Sophie in Sarajevo. So here you have this event. You have this incident. You have a person shot by people who we don't really, nobody ever really takes the time to ask, what are you? Why are you? And there are as many arguments as to who they were, what they were, why they were, as Carter has pills. Nobody to this day really grasps the entirety of what they were doing and why they were doing it. Oh, we think we know. We assume that we know. But the people back then sure didn't. One side assumed that it was one thing. The other side assumed that it was something else. And pretty soon this minor, not well-liked archduke with his wife that the emperor hated, the end result of this particular little argument is millions of people dead. Most of the monarchies in the world destroyed. The social fabric that had existed prior to 1914 for as long as many people could remember, gone. Chaos ensues. Is what replaces it better? Nobody really knows. But in June and July of 1914, nobody was taking the time to ask any of those questions. What if somebody had said, okay, wait a minute, let's sit down and talk about why this has happened. What's the thinking process here? Is this guy that actually shot them really some sort of on-fire revolutionary who believes that by shooting these two people, Serbia will be free of Austria-Hungarian influence? Does he really believe that? And if so, why? Or is he just some guy that wants a beer and a sandwich and got lost and happened to see them there and thought to himself, it's a target of opportunity. Millions of people die over that failure to discuss anything. Now, I don't know, although I'm certain some will argue, that millions of lives hang in the balance right now over what this country does over the next few weeks and a couple of months. Justice Kennedy retires. Half the country, it seems like, loses its mind. Oh, this is tragic. This is the apocalypse. The other half seems celebratory. Yeah, we're going to stick it to them. We're going to get 6-4 wins. I'm sorry. I still find that humorous. I see a lot of 6-4 decisions in the future. You do, huh? You see a lot of those. I love social media because that's, you know. Anyway, point being that nobody's thinking. Patton said, when everybody's thinking the same thing, nobody's actually thinking. And you have two sides of thought processes here. And all of that's going to come into play in the Senate Judiciary Committee as whoever this next person is sits down there. And instead of actually delving into why they think what they think, There will be a bunch of pointed questions as to what do you think about, and if the answer doesn't please the person that's asking the question, then the person answering the question will be labeled as something. They will be labeled as something horrible by the person who disagrees with them, and something wonderful by the person who does agree with them. And we still won't know why they think the way they do. And when you're dealing with a Supreme Court justice, might not that be beneficial to know why they think the way they do? What is it in their biases? What is it in their thought processes? What is it in their experience that leads them to think a certain way? I get this a lot about prayer in the schools. Dave, you're a conservative chat show host, but you're against school prayers. Why? That's not conservative position. Conservatives should be for this. Really? Because I don't think they should. And I'm a conservative. Very few people ever take the time to ask me, why do you feel that way? And if they do, then I'm happy to explain to them, because I grew up as a religious minority in an area where there was a religious majority that basically, with a big smile on its face, saying, we're not forcing you to do this, forced us to do it. Every assembly was opened with a prayer, which supposedly was by a randomly selected student. But when you have 99% of your students are one faith, that randomization, it doesn't play real well, does it? It becomes a democracy rather than a republic. That's why I'm against it, because I believe that prayer in school isn't about having a prayer in school. It's about you forcing my child to pray the way you want my child to pray, rather than the way I want them to pray. But nobody wants to think in those terms, do they? Nobody wants to think, oh, yeah, I guess there's some validity to that. No, what they want to think is, you must hate God. You must be a heathen. And they throw labels at you, and they throw insults at you, because they don't bother to learn why you think the way you do. They don't question your experiences. They don't question any of that stuff. And here we're going to have Supreme Court justices that are going to be asked what they think about a subject, rather than why they think about a subject the way they do, which is actually the more important question. But instead, we're going to be treated to months, weeks, whatever, of arguments about anything and everything, and it's all going to come down to one subject anyway. One topic. This person is going to overturn this, and we can't have that. Oh, my God. Well, it doesn't quite work that way, but that's what people will be convinced of, isn't it? Hatred, much like love, renders its votaries credulous. Doesn't it? It's 5:55, Dave, 209-565-3283 is the text machine. Stay with us back right after this little break.
Science Underground with your host, Anissa Ramirez.
This week, understanding concussions. I'm Anissa Ramirez, and this is
Science Underground.
Concussions have been in the news. To learn more, one of the leading experts, Boston University's Dr. Robert Cantu, explains.
Now, concussion occurs when the brain is violently shaken, either from a direct hit to the head or an indirect hit that whiplashes the head on the neck.
That violent shaking stretches brain cells, which are also known as neurons, and impairs their ability to send messages properly. Now, depending on where the brain is injured, there are many symptoms, and they fall into four baskets. There are cognitive symptoms, difficulty with memory, focus, attention, and processing of new information, emotional symptoms of depression, anxiety, and panic attacks. There are sleep symptoms, too.
And then by far and away, the biggest basket of symptoms are physical symptoms, or so-called somatic symptoms, of which headache is the most common, lightheadedness, dizziness, sensitivity to light and noise, trouble with balance.
Interestingly, it's been found that women suffer twice as many more concussions than men for the same sport. Now that's because
people with the weakest necks have the highest number of concussions, and those with the strongest necks have the lowest number.
Those studies also say that women are more honest when it comes to reporting their injuries. Weaker necks put children at risk, too. And this is troubling because...
And if you injure a young person's brain, you can prevent him or her from reaching their full genetic potential, whether that be an intellectual potential or the way they were genetically meant to be in terms of their emotions.
So if you play a sport, use your head and don't use your head. Future you will thank you. I'm Anissa Ramirez, and this was
Science Underground.
It started off as a normal day. I felt fine when I arrived at the plant.
Ruth Junius's life was about to change.
Then I dropped my keys. They kept slipping out of my hand. My arm felt numb. A coworker asked me if I was okay, and I couldn't speak. I started to get scared.
Ruth was having a stroke. People around her weren't sure what to do.
They thought I should go home or lie down, but I knew something was very wrong. I wrote 911 on a piece of paper with my other hand, and someone called for me.
Because everyone acted quickly, doctors at the hospital were able to give Ruth treatment that started to reverse the symptoms.
Within a few minutes, I was talking again. I didn't know a thing about stroke before I had one. Now I make sure that my friends and family know all the signs of stroke so they'll get help fast if they need it.
No stroke. Know the signs. Act in time. Call 1-800-352-9424 for more information. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, National Institutes of Health.
Responding to possible carbon monoxide poisoning.
Carbon monoxide is an odorless, colorless, tasteless gas that kills more than 500 Americans every year. Never use generators, grills, camp stoves, or other gasoline or charcoal burning devices inside your home, basement, or garage, or near a window. If it's cold, stay with friends or family or in a shelter. To learn more, call 1-800-CDC-INFO.
Hi, I'm Gerald McRaney. Is there anything you wouldn't do to live longer or feel better? Would you make a few simple changes in your lifestyle if you knew it could save your life? Take cholesterol. A high blood cholesterol level can cause strokes and serious heart disease, but exercise and simple changes in your diet can reduce cholesterol and make you feel better.
For your free booklet, visit the Will Rogers Institute at WRinstitute.org or call toll-free 877-957-7575 and find us on Facebook and Twitter. The Will Rogers Institute, since 1936.
This is the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Oh, you idiots! Whose idea was that?
Dave's?
What?
Oh, well, that's just great, Dave.
Well, it was an idea. I never said it was a great. Welcome back. Plausibly Live, this is the Dave Bowman Show right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. You want to join us, text machine, area code 209-565-DAVE. Email is dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web, thedavebowmanshow.com. And on Facebook and Twitter, just look for The Dave Bowman Show. There are innumerable ways for you to get a hold of us, so there's no reason not to. I guess for somebody like me, the process, I look at something like this happening, a Supreme Court justice retiring, as an exciting moment. I look at this as an opportunity to see the process unfold, to introduce Americans to the ideas of government, the principles of how we operate, the laws behind what we do, the constitutionality of it. I look at this as an opportunity for people to learn, but I understand that most people look at this as a political exercise of enforcing their ideology on the other side. Whether you're talking about a Democrat president appointing a liberal justice or a Republican president appointing an allegedly conservative justice, and I say that because most of the time, when a liberal justice is appointed, he or she is referred to in the press as a moderate, whereas a Republican justice is always referred to as a conservative justice and usually turns out not to be so. A conservative justice, such as John Roberts, would have found Obamacare to be unconstitutional, but through an incredibly convoluted ruling, we decided that it wasn't. It usually turns out that way. It's hard to, because we never really delve into the justices and their ideologies and their ideas and why they think the way they do. We assume things based on who appointed them. That's the main thing we assume. We do go back and read their rulings, and we kind of talk their prior rulings if they have any. Remember, Justice Kagan didn't have, she was never a judge anywhere. We do kind of go back in there, but we do it with a political eyeball. We don't do it with a searching eye. We do it with we're trying to find something wrong with this person so that we can force them to withdraw. Well, this person didn't pay their illegal alien nanny. Get them out of here. So next, who's next? Until we don't so much reach a compromise as we do, we just kind of run out of steam and everybody gets tired of it. And we go, oh, shit, that's the way it used to work. Now, it doesn't work that way anymore. My expectation is that Donald Trump will announce his nominee probably within the next 2 weeks. I can't imagine it would take him much longer than that based on the way that he operates. And remember that the Senate has done away with the cloture rule. They've exercised the nuclear option thanks to Harry Reid. And now it's a simple majority vote. So there will be hearings that will be held at which the Democrats will attempt to drag out. They will attempt to lengthen that out because they think if they can make it to November and there's a big blue wave and suddenly they're in charge of the Senate, then they can make the same argument that the Republicans made before about the appointment, and this is the American people speaking their will. They don't want this person. They don't want that. They don't want this person making the nominations, whatever. And there'll be more arguments about it. The Republicans are looking at it going, well, we got to get somebody in there that we like. We got to do it before November because that way, you know, but then we're going to go on summer vacation. And so there's that issue involved here. And then we got to run campaigns. And do we want this to be an issue in the campaign or post campaign? What do we want here? What's the political element of it? In many ways. I understand some things here, but in many ways, I think getting rid of cloture was probably, well, getting rid of cloture when it comes to justices, probably not a horrible idea. But at the same time, it's an idea that had unexpected consequences, didn't it? Again, when Harry Reid did that, he applied it only to non-Supreme Court justices and below. Republicans then turned around and applied it to all of them. But in doing so, he was, at the time, it was the D.C. Circuit Court that he wanted justices approved on, and he wasn't getting anywhere. He wasn't going to get anywhere, and he was afraid that if he didn't get it, Obamacare was in real danger. And so they took action based on a very short-sighted view of things, and ultimately short-sighted views end up costing a lot downstream. Much like sending a ultimatum to Serbia that the king and everybody thought was a great idea. Sorry, the emperor and everybody thought was a great idea. Let's send them an ultimatum, and if they don't, we'll threaten them. Well, that didn't work out so well, did it? Much in the same way, Reid's nuclear option. You're not going to find a lot of Democrats right now that are praising him for doing that, even back then. But they're doing that with hindsight, that Justice Roberts ultimately saved their thing anyway. They didn't really need the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. In the end, nobody at the time knew that. It's easy with hindsight to criticize that. But today we're looking forward going, okay, number one, I mean, I've got a list of who the 25 most likely nominees are. I haven't gone through it with a fine-tooth comb. I'm not sure. You know, you're dealing with Donald Trump. Okay, Trump does things sometimes sometimes he just does them just because he gets up in the morning and he thinks this'll shake things up. So while there's 25 names on this list of most probable nominees, it's possible that he's thinking about somebody we got no idea who is. It's possible. There are people who are calling for Jeff Sessions, Trey Gowdy. There are people calling for people that, you know, don't have any judicial experience. And again, I don't necessarily have a problem with that. But since we've gone to this straight vote, majority vote, the hearings are actually only meaningful in how long the Democrats can drag them on. And realistically, they can only drag it on as long as the Republicans allow them to do so. There will, it's kabuki theater now. And once again, whoever the nominee ends up being, we will know very little about why they think the way they do. We will not ask the question. The only real issue for the last, 40 years on the Supreme Court has been abortion. That's it. I mean, I know there's other things that butterfly around that. But really, if a nominee is pro or anti-abortion, has really been the issue. That's the litmus test. And if they're against it, the Democrats are going to viciously oppose them and find some way to do that. And if they're for it, then the Republicans are going to do that and the Democrats are going to back them. But we never talk about why. Why are you for it or against it? What in your experience causes you to take that position? I would love to hear that. I would love to hear a senator ask that question and then just say, sit back and say, take as long as you need and explain it to me. I used to want to ask that question for a gubernatorial candidate in California. We had a gubernatorial candidate in California once upon a time who, for most of his life, had been pro-abortion and then decided to run for governor as a Republican and decided he was anti-abortion. And I could never get him to explain why. What caused the change? Look, I'm okay if you changed your mind. I don't have a problem with that, but I want to know why you changed your mind. And the answer, of course, was because I wanted to run as a Republican. That was the only reason I changed my mind. Nothing actually in him changed. Nothing still has changed. And he's still running for offices in California and still not answering that question. Only now he was a Democrat. Now he's a Republican. Then he was a Republican. And now he's an independent. So now nobody will question him on anything. Why do you feel that way? Now his whole spiel is both parties are bad. Well, that may be so. But what in your experience has told you that, other than the fact that you were soundly defeated as both once upon a time? And now you think you can run this way and win. Whoever this judicial nominee is will be asked a lot of questions about what they think, but very rarely will they be asked why. And ultimately, when they put whoever this is on the court, and it might be the first one, it might be the second one, who knows? Who knows what fight ensues over the next few months, but I know it's going to be interesting and it's going to be political. And it's going to be fought out on social media at 140 characters at a time. It's going to be zingers. It's going to be memes. It's going to be arguments, debates. Friendships will be lost. People will be put on silent. People will be banned from this and welcomed into that. And nobody will ever ask the real in-depth questions. Nobody will say to somebody else, look, you oppose this nominee. Why? What is it about this nominee with your experience and your beliefs that causes you to oppose them? And if the only thing is abortion, well, look, I'm not in favor of abortion either. I don't support abortion. I don't have an abortion, but I also believe it's a personal decision. And I don't think there's any way in hell this court overturns that. I don't think they do. I've read three articles this morning where people, Roe v. Wade will now be overturned. Slow down there, cowboy. Slow down. The Supreme Court doesn't just walk into the building one day and go, well, all right, Roe v. Wade was wrong. Done. Doesn't happen that way. You're going to have a whole lot more than that, and nobody's thinking in those terms. Nobody's thinking about what it would take to get a case before the United States Supreme Court that says we're going to overturn Roe v. Wade. Instead, we'd just rather argue about, well, if you could, would you? Look, if I could go to the moon, I would, but there's a lot of steps to be made between here and there, and most of those steps for me are impossible. Could Roe v. Wade be overturned? Well, sure, it's possible. Is it probable? But the entirety of the debate, in most cases, will revolve around that. And we still won't know the whys and the wherefores. We still won't have a discussion about why this is even important, why this shouldn't be a state's rights issue. I mean, if you're really that pro-abortion, wouldn't you rather have it be a state's rights issue? We could have those discussions, but we won't. Instead, we'll point fingers and we'll make postings, and at the end of the day, we won't be anywhere. We won't have any understanding of the other person's position. That's one of the things I think we've lost in social media, and we've lost it in that because we no longer talk to each other. If we speak at all, we talk at somebody, and we usually do it through writing on social media, which writing is a wonderful thing, but it is very difficult to communicate tone and intention sometimes in writing. Sometimes sentences that are written come across completely the opposite of the way they were meant. Or at least two people looking at it go, he meant this. Well, no, he meant that. And nobody bothers to say to the person who wrote it, what did you mean? Instead, we have knockdown, drag-out arguments over what it means, just like we talked about before, with two people looking at the identical piece of scripture and going, well, it means this. No, it means that. Two people looking at a rule in a rule book going, well, it means this. No, it means that. Two people looking at a replay of an NFL play going, that's a catch. No, it's not. And then we rewrite the rule. Well, the catch is this. And it's more confused than ever. And then we go back 8 years and we say, well, okay, under the new rules, that was a catch 8 years ago, but nothing we can do about it now. So what the hell did we accomplish by doing this? I don't know. I don't know who the nominee is going to be. I don't really care, to be honest with you. I know that predicting what a Supreme Court will do is it's a ridiculous task. It's impossible to do in any given case. I know you can sometimes kind of predict what somebody will say because it wasn't difficult to predict that the Janus case would be 5-4. That was not difficult. You knew it was 4-4, so it was really 1-0 at the end of the day. And for my part, over the years, I've learned to trust Justice Kennedy. I find most of his rationales and reasonings and rulings to be, well, libertarian. And I appreciate that. Hatred as well as love renders its votaries credulous. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau said that. And I think it really applies to what we're talking about here. It's one of those slogans that you hear. You hear that saying, hatred as well as love renders its votaries credulous. Oh, yeah, that's great. But when you start breaking it down, I mean, I read it this morning when it came across my email this morning. I read it and I went, okay. And then I started looking up the words because I thought I understood it, but I wasn't absolutely certain that I understood it. Hey, what is a votary? Anybody know? A votary is a person who is a devoted follower, an adherent, an advocate of someone or something. Now, I guess I kind of knew that. I'm sure that contextually I understood that. But hate as well as love renders its votaries, its adherents, credulous. A credulous is one of those words that, well, again, I thought I knew what it meant. I hear the word, I love the word incredulous. I love the word, it means, in my word, it means believe, right? It means I believe something. But really, in the 1700s, the word credulous meant something slightly different. And if you go back in the word, the etymology of the word, you find that very quickly, that what he means is something really different than what we think he's saying. Hatred, as well as love, renders its votaries, renders its adherents credulous, having or showing too much of a readiness to believe things regardless of whether they're true or not. Hatred, as well as love, makes its followers gullible. Both, he says, makes you willing to believe something that might not be true. No matter how passionate you are about whoever the Supreme Court nominee is being great, you might be so willing to believe that you believe stuff that really isn't so. You're not willing to look at, and the other side is equally true. Your hatred of whoever this nominee is may cause you to ignore reality and to believe things in a gullible manner that makes you see things that really aren't there. And there's no middle ground, is there? Hatred, as well as love, renders its votaries credulous. And how true is that about everything in life? How willing am I to believe bad things about people and things that I adore? And how willing am I to believe good things about people that may be bad, but I adore them? We're so quick to accept things that aren't true because they fit our bias, because they fit our agenda, that we never ask what's really going on here. We've become credulous. We've become naive. We've become gullible. The smarter we think we are, the more information we have available to us on a daily basis. Every bit of human history is available to us at the instant push of a button. We can find out anything we want to know, pretty much. And yet we'd rather believe 140 character in a meme. We'd rather not put any work into actually learning anything, because then we might actually have to take some action that we don't really want to take. See, that's the problem with knowledge. Once you learn something, you can't generally unlearn it. And if that knowledge that you learn challenges what you believe, well, which is more powerful, what I believe? Am I willing to set aside that knowledge so that I can believe what I want to believe, or am I going to act on this knowledge, which might take me in a completely different direction? And that's the story of my faith tradition in a nutshell. We want you to believe a certain thing. Great. Why do we say we believe something opposite of that? Oh, don't ask questions, just believe. No, I'd rather ask the questions. And when you start asking the questions, guess what? You end up going over that way, and people over there get mad at you. I still, to this day, have people who will not talk to me because I left the faith. Well, did you ask me why I left the faith? Did you seek to delve what I learned, what I think, what I saw? No, you just said, well, you're going to hell, and I believe that to be true. Hatred, as well as love, renders its voters credulous. Our politics over the next few months is going to get nasty. It's going to be vicious. It's going to be incredible. We should strive to be above that. We should strive to ask the real questions that matter. And we should strive to not be credulous. We should strive to not be naive, not be gullible, not to believe things just because it's out there, just because it's on the meme, just because. Yeah, I know it's too much effort for most people. Most people are busy, you know. They'd rather watch Big Brother. They'd rather watch football or baseball. I know I'd rather do that. I don't want to have to worry about this stuff, but guess what? That's what makes a virtuous citizen. at least having some idea of why we're doing what we're doing. Being involved, being engaged. We don't need a 28th Amendment to tell Congress not to sleep on their couches and not to pass laws that don't apply to us. What we need to be is paying attention to what's going on and voting appropriately. But we would rather be steeped in our hatred and or our love, which renders us credulous. And at the end of the day, that gives us the government that we have pretty much come to expect, which will be on full display over the next few weeks. And it will be sad and entertaining to watch all at the same time. That's the problem that we're going to have. How do we change it? I don't know. I know we got to keep asking questions. We have to rise above. You can't take the argument, well, they did it first. As soon as you fall into that trap, you're the problem. But if we can bring ourselves up to the point where we're not doing that, then maybe that's a start. Who knows? Got to get running. It's Thursday. I have much to do. Probably you do too. So please take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there. So don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman, and this is my show. Right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. We're here every Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific time, whether it's daylight or standard. And I have a good time. I hope you do as well. Make sure you download us, like us, share us on all your social media. Get the word out. Bring people in. Stay tuned. Coming up next on the P99 radio side, we've got Tim Price. He's talking about George Soros today, and he's asking questions. See? Don't believe the memes. Ask the questions. See you tomorrow, everybody, for a Friday episode of Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Plausibly Live is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. To contact Dave directly, call or text area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 209-565-3283. The email address is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. For more information or to hear past shows, go to www.plausiblylive.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.